Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we talk about the early returns of Jason Tatum and the Boston Celtics as a whole, how Tatum is slotted in. After that, we talk about an awesome game between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Denver Nuggets, MVP caliber performances from Nikola Jokic and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We talk about some interesting things in that game, as well as the MVP conversation. And then we check in on the Eastern Conference once again. The Pistons are on a losing streak. The Sixers in a tough slot right now. Should we be concerned, or is just a blip in the radar? And finally, we close with rookie talk. Steve dropped another excellent rookie ranking, so we go through his top 10 and reveal where we're at with the All Rookie and Rookie of the Year awards. Please tap in. We're going to have some fun today. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones. Junior. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. And I'm ready to talk some basketball, guys. Soup it up.
All right, we're gonna have some fun. We're gonna talk some basketball. We got some returns. We got some debuts. And I just want to quickly say, to peel the curtain back, the long-term dunkers know, the new folks is gonna fill you in. One of my annoyances in the podcast world is when we hop on here, we have awesome conversations, it's great, and then 10 minutes after we finish recording, we get news, and I'm just like, darn, that kind of stinks. Would love to talk about that. I bring this up because it is March 10th, which is the unofficial but maybe official WNBA CBA deadline. They want to have a deal done so the season isn't delayed, et cetera. I hope, one, that we get news today so we can just get the W free agency officially rolling, the offseason officially rolling. But two, I would like for that news to break during the recording of the podcast. I will be very sad if this gets done at 3:30 Eastern or something, well after we finish recording the pod. So I just want to get that off my chest before we get rolling. I would like for that to happen in quick order.
look at you being greedy, man.
Not being greedy. Hey, listen, I want the league back, and it'll be very convenient if it happens within the next hour and a half. But anyway, to a more serious basketball conversation, let's shift back to the NBA side. Steve, on Friday, we talked about the impending return of Jason Tatum. We talked about things that we were excited to see, what we were going to be looking for rotationally or on the court. We talked about how annoying the discourse around Jason Tatum was. We finally got two games under the belt of Jason Tatum. Across those two games, 17.5 points, 7.5 rebounds, 4.5 assists in about 27 minutes per game. The Celtics have won his minutes by 17 total points. Two wins for the Boston Celtics, which is the most important thing. So just to kind of broaden the scope, Steve, what did you enjoy about the Jason Tatum experience? What did you like about the Jason Tatum return?
The fact that he's on the basketball court. I mean, that's the most important thing. If we're talking about what did you enjoy, what did you like, if that's the question, then yeah, he's back playing basketball. He's doing what he loves to do and doing it at a high level. I mean, I think the biggest thing for me when you look at Jason Tatum, it's just a reminder of, A, the type of talent that he is, and he's in a stronger fit, I think, within this specific Boston Celtics team. Not that, we've seen this team play at a championship level, but the way this team plays, certain people need to create offense and create shots. Certain people necessarily are not going to be out there to play defense and kind of play hard and keep things moving. Jason Tatum kind of has the ability to play off ball, on ball, but doesn't have the responsibility that you would assume Jason Tatum would have. I think that's a good spot for him to be in as he returns to where, okay, you kind of felt, even in the first return against Dallas, the wave element of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown where, okay, one of them has the ball. We don't have anything. We go to the other side and get to the other person where they can attack and get downhill. But, I mean, he's a playmaker. So he's gonna engage defenses. He's going to be able to get in the paint if you're in a drop. He's going to be able to get to his pull-up or find a roller. And that just adds a different element for Boston. So the biggest thing was just kind of watching him and seeing, okay, there's rust here, but he still looks like Jason Tatum. He still has the same animation package. He's still getting to the same pull-ups. Maybe might be a little bit more tired than we've seen before, but overall, he's been himself. And then defensively, I don't want to say it was my concern, but it was more like, okay, what's this going to look like? Obviously, he's not going to take the prime matchups early, but okay, can you kind of nail the rotation? Boston plays a specific style of defense where, okay, if you drive, we're going to show help, we're going to recover, we're going to rotate. How many of those reps can you hit? And so that's where I'm like, okay, they're going to put him in action. Is he sliding his feet? Is he able to recover? Can he make multiple efforts defensively? That's probably going to take a little bit more time. But because Boston is Boston, they're going to have people around him to insulate him to a degree. And so you just want to kind of see if there's a consistency there for Jason Tatum on that end of the floor, where he's able to just kind of make multiple efforts, be in the right spots, help recover, close back out, keep the ball in front. That's going to be kind of the buildup, I think, going into playoffs.
I got you. I think for me, to kind of start at the beginning, we got the early report before the Dallas game that not only was he back, he's starting and there's no minutes restriction. And I was like, wait a minute, hold on. I did this whole bit on the pod. Like, he's probably going to be like 15 to 20 minutes and then we're going to ramp this thing up. What do you mean? He's just immediately in the starting lineup and there's going to be no restriction here. So off rip, I'm just like, okay, what is this usage going to look like? He must be really ready to go. Again, it's not going to be 36 minutes peak playoff usage or anything like that. But the expectation for me is now, okay, this may be a little bit more than I was anticipating already. And so to get to that Dallas game, oh, go ahead.
Wait, can I raise my hand real quick? It's very funny that everyone did the no minutes restriction thing because Joe Mazzulla said that out loud. He played 27 minutes in both games.
Both games. He sure did.
Go ahead.
we love consistency on this side. But to that point, I was like, okay, so we may get more Tatum than I am anticipating, like barring foul trouble, injury, that kind of thing. And so to get to the Dallas game and the playmaking pops immediately, like it's 7 assists for him. It was 14 potential assists in that first game, Steve. And in that first quarter in particular, like there were multiple lobs to Nemias Kata. Like one was disrupted. He was fouled on another one. So like, there's two there. He's making kickouts to the opposite corner, sometimes to the strong side corner. And it's like, okay, he is not only making the reads, but even to your Russ point, Steve, like the Russ was more so with just the legs. And like just kind of the energy transfer, just kind of the general explosion there. That's where you saw a lot of the early jump shots for him were short. We got the missed dunk that we saw in the highlight package a little bit earlier. It's like, okay, he's still trying to get that part. But in terms of how quickly he was processing things on the floor, I was very impressed that that was not like a beat late. And then like the pass placement was a little bit off or something like that. He just had it off rip as a playmaker. And I feel like that bodes well in terms of the overall integration. To where, to your earlier point, we can kind of go side to side here. We can use Jason Tatum as a guy that can initiate our offense early on. If we don't have it, Jaylen Brown can end it for you, or vice versa. This defense is already tilted. Jason Tatum is incredibly good at hitting the open man and doing so in a timely fashion. We really can just keep your defense in a blender now. So, like, I really enjoyed the playmaking portion of the program. The fact that he was willing to get downhill, you saw it in spurts in the Dallas game, and you really saw it early in that Cleveland game. I thought that was encouraging. And so for me, it's just how long is it going to take for him to consistently have his legs? Because him deciding I am going and the first step when he decides to attack, like that seems to be there. The actual vertical pop is not yet. And so I am curious to see, does that come in game 5? Is that game 8? Is that coming in game 3? You know, next time we see Jason Tatum, we'll see. But like that's something I'm keeping an eye on. But like the processing speed popped for me very early on. And it was very funny to me that he missed the dunk. Then he gets the putback slam in the Dallas game, and it just felt like he was never going to miss again. It's just like a real life, oh, I can still do this. So that's how that works. And he just reels off 4 straight makes after the putback slams. Like, oh boy, it is officially Jason Tatum time. So I'm with you. Glad he was out there. Surprised he was out there as much as he was off rip. But then just kind of watching him map the floor was a pleasure for me.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing that has been said in this is when Jason Tatum is ready to come back, he's going to be back. And so to Boston's credit, hey, he's back. He's all the way back. We're playing him. He's in what we do. I understand that. I'm a little surprised that you're so surprised by the playmaking, because that's been a big growth point for Jason Tatum over the last few years, is being able to kind of make the right reads, make the right plays, the responsibility to see how defenses are guarding him and make the right, you know, the right reads for Boston. And I think, again, it speaks to how he fits into this specific team, right? Like, I think in prior years, they kind of had some star power and it was, okay, I need to get to my shot. I make enough shots. I can make the right reads. And you can kind of see a little bit of a pressure relief from Jason Tatum with the way that he was being used, especially in the first game, where, okay, I have my pockets to attack. I'm being used in certain ways. It's not all on me to create everything. So I can now come off this down screen, see the space, and make the right play. I can get a pick and roll, see the space, make the right play. I get a handoff, see the space, and make the right play. And I think the biggest thing, if you're a Celtics fan, is nothing really felt forced. You know, you have Jaylen Brown, you have Jason Tatum, you have two talents. But now, you know, we can kind of go out of a timeout and use Jason Tatum as a screener and say, you know what? Yeah, you attack Sam Merrill. Let's see what that looks like. But we don't necessarily need you to do that to operate offensively, right? Like, we don't need you to open the bottle for us. So I think that's what's something you got to keep a track of, the difference in how he plays and how Boston plays because of that fact.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, like, it was never, is Jason Tatum able to make passes? It's just more, the Celtics have played 60 plus games. How quickly is he going to fit into like the cadence of making these reads? And so the fact that he was already at kind of like B plus A level off rip was where I was like, oh, okay, this is nice. This is going to be, I already knew it was going to be additive. This is even more additive more quickly than I anticipated, I guess is my general point there. I guess to your wave portion, Steve, because you mentioned like being able to start a possession with Tatum, flow to Brown and vice versa. Were you surprised at all by the actual rotation? Because it felt like Joe Mazzulla kept Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown pretty paired. There was a lot of those two are on the bench together while Derek White and Peyton Pritchard get to do their thing with the second unit. Were you surprised it was less, we're going to have the Brown offense and then we're going to have the Tatum offense and more just kind of keeping those two together?
Why would you have the Brown offense and the Tatum offense? We can just play them together. I think you keep the pressure off Jason Tatum by playing him with Jaylen Brown and allowing him to get into the flow of the basketball and see what he can do without necessarily feeling like, hey, I have to do things, especially early on coming back from that injury, playing with Jaylen Brown, see what happens. I think there's a lot of times where people go with rotations and it's very easy to kind of map things out and put bars on a screen and kind of say, oh, well, these players are playing with each other. It's a very sensitive deal in the sense that you don't want to waste minutes to a degree and have someone play X amount, but we're playing a certain type of basketball, right? Like, so my mind goes to Denver, right? Everyone gets mad at the non-Jokic minutes, right? But okay, you play Jamal Murray with the second unit, and it's a separate point. We may get into it, but you play him with the second unit at the start of a quarter. Is this all Jamal Murray pick and roll? Are you not using Jamal Murray all the way? Have you gotten anything out of these 3 minutes with Jamal Murray on the court? And now you've lost 3 potential minutes of Jamal Murray playing with Nikola Jokic. Like, there's a balance you have to have when it comes to your rotation. You have to kind of play certain guys together, try and maximize it. You know, the hope is we can kind of do things without these guys on the court. Like, I think the one thing you have to remember is, like, if you're coaching, if you're thinking basketball wise, I want multiple things to be working at the same time. I want to be able to do multiple things. I don't want my whole success to be tied to one thing working. And so I'm not surprised that Tatum was out there just exclusively with Brown, just because it takes the pressure off of him and allows him to play in a flow and play in a way that it's going to let him be in a rhythm that he needs to be in on the court. So that didn't really shock me. I don't think you have to necessarily go with, oh, it's the Tatum offense and the Brown offense. No, we're the Celtics. This is how we play. Mm-hmm. We have our best two players on the court together. And when they're off the court, hey, Peyton Pritchard, would you like to shoot shots? And would everyone else like to play hard? That's the Celtics.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is why I want to have this conversation with you, who has like the actual coaching experience, because I'm always intrigued by like who's matching up with who, what the rotations look like. And like, it was interesting to me to kind of compare how the Celtics were bringing Jason Tatum along in these two games compared to like the early returns of Darius Garland, where Ty Lue's like, actually, DG, you're coming off the bench right now. We want you to be comfortable making plays, making reads without having to defer to Kawhi Leonard type beat. Like, obviously, Jason Tatum, Darius Garland, different players, different positions. But like the concept of, we are integrating this star into the system. We want to give you room to kind of explore, get used to things. And then we're going to pair our top two guys together. That felt like more divide with the Clippers. And so I guess in a sense, I was kind of expecting a little bit of that with Jason Tatum. It's like, not that you can't play with Jaylen Brown, because as we talked about on Friday, they have won championships together. They've won many games. Like, obviously, they fit together. But I was just kind of anticipating, would Joe Mazzulla split those two up early on just to kind of speed track some of the rhythm that Jason Tatum's going to have to establish? So, like, that's why I was curious about it. And I think your response makes a ton of sense. And this is why I wanted to ask you.
No, you're good, dude. I mean, you don't have to defend it. It's fantastic. I mean, I think the clip. The Clippers portion was also mostly, hey, Darius Garland, really respect you. Won't you have a great run? Kawhi Leonard is cooking right now, and he's not going to stop cooking for a little bit. So we want you to do all those things, but do it over here for a little bit, and then we'll bring you in. And, I mean, that's a whole different story as far as the impact you can see. Like, the Knicks were starting to trap Kawhi Leonard. It's like, oh, Darius Garland gets to play. He gets a tilted defense. That's pretty fun. Not to go too deep in Clippers talk, but, I mean, it's kind of fun. It's like, hey, Darius Garland, do all the offensive stuff. Hey, Benedict Mathurin, you also do offensive stuff. That's fine. Don't worry about it. We'll figure the rest out. Hey, Kawhi Leonard, keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, we have enough guys to run around. It's fine. Just get them up.
Everyone else, defend. Please defend. We need you to defend. But okay, back to the Celtics. I actually want to zoom out a little bit on Boston. This is a new conversation, so I don't anticipate this being like 20 minutes or anything. But I am just so impressed with what Boston has done this season and what they have been in this calendar year. And obviously, there was more of a spotlight on them over this past weekend because Jason Tatum returned. But it just further reinforced just how well coached and just how much of a rhythm they've been in on both ends of the floor. Like, you bring Jason Tatum back and you don't really miss a beat with what you're attempting to do. Like, it didn't feel like the ball movement was worse. It didn't feel like the defense structurally was worse or anything like that. And you zoom out with this group, they are second in the league in net rating per clean the glass, Steve. Best point differential in the Eastern Conference right now. Per clean the glass, they're second in offense. They're sixth in defense. This is just a well-oiled machine right now. So, like, I really just want to give a quick salute to the Celtics as a whole for what they've been able to build this year and having this kind of thing established so that making the integration with Jason Tatum a little bit easier. Like, they've been structurally sound all year long.
I mean, I think to add to that, the best teams in today's NBA have an identity. They have a way that they play every single night. And you could argue Boston's probably been one of the most, if not the most, consistent teams stylistically. You know exactly what you're going to get when you put the Boston Celtics on. We're going to defend. Are you driving into the paint? There will be bodies. And they do it in different ways. They swarm sometimes. We're super active. Now we're taking it away. They're hovering around and, hey, we'll help and then get back out. But you're going to end up with bodies in the paint if you get in there. And then offensively, we're going to shoot threes. That's not everything that we do. But if it's there, we'll take it. We'll create it. And then if you defend us, we'll try and move and get ourselves the best shot possible. We're going to free flow and play. Like, they just know who they are. It's why you have like a Baylor Shireman playing with high confidence level, a Nemeas Keita playing with high confidence level, because they know their role. They execute every single night. And that's what's put Boston in this position where you keep waiting for the other shoe to drop and there's not another shoe to drop. Joe Mazzulla refuses to allow you to see the other shoe that's allowed to drop because they just do what they do every single night. And so that's been one of the joys of just watching Boston all year long, is even when they fall short, right? Like, they're not undefeated. They're going to take some losses. They're not the they're not the best team in the world in the sense that we're just going to overwhelm you, but you have to deal with us, right? Like Detroit, you have to deal with us. And I'm sure you have Pistons thoughts because apparently it's time to do Pistons discourse because they lost a couple games. Guess that's what we have to do, right? Legally required to do that. But you look at those type of teams, like, when do you see the Boston Celtics get sped up? When do you see the Boston Celtics not sure what they're supposed to do defensively? When do you see the Boston Celtics have a lineup where guys are trying to figure out who they are or what they're trying to do? You don't see that. And so that I think is a credit to Joe Mazzulla, the staff, the players for buying in, and the players for holding each other accountable every single night. You know, look at the way they space the floor when they bring the ball up. Everyone knows exactly where they're supposed to go. They flow into the next action. Mm-hmm. They keep pressure on defenses. Like, they've just understood the assignment to an absurd degree, and they've earned the right to kind of put themselves in that top tier in the East.
Yeah, like, I think to bounce off of that, Steve, and I tweeted about this while I was watching the Cavs game, watched it the day after, and I was just like, they're well-coached, they're structurally sound, and like, there is something for everyone. Like, if you are someone that enjoys all the threes getting up, being put up because you like shooting, well, the Boston Celtics have the third highest three-point rate in the league. If you are someone that's kind of tired of the threes, just like, hey, the mid-range game is still important, the Boston Celtics are seventh in mid-range rate. Jaylen Brown has taken a bunch. Jason Tatum is going to take a bunch, et cetera. You have that going for you if you want that. Hey, I sure wish when teams played defense in the NBA, which is a dumb take, but that's another rant for another day, the Boston Celtics been flirting around with a top five defense pretty much all year long. To your point, Steve, they swarm as a team structurally when it comes to their help. Like, you do not get to the rim against the Boston Celtics, and you don't have much success when you do attempt shots at the rim against the Boston Celtics. Guess who has the lowest opponent rim rate in the NBA, Steve? The Boston Celtics. They don't let you get the easy stuff. They end possessions. They don't foul. They don't turn the ball over. They generate a bunch of extra possessions on the offensive glass. So if you like the dirty work, you get that too. They're just very good, very sound, and pretty versatile. And like, that kind of leads to my broader question, as we're going to flow into Pistons talk a little bit later. But like, the Celtics have kind of earned the right to get into this conversation of, we are the best team in the Eastern Conference. Like, in a literal sense, they have the best point differential in the East right now. They're still second in the standings. But like, how close are you to Boston being there? Are you still holding firm on Detroit right now?
I'm still on Detroit. Like, this feels like one of the few times they've had a losing streak this year. If you go look at their losses. So yeah, they've lost four in a row. Adversity is always going to knock on your door at some point in the NBA regular season. And Detroit has to finally kind of deal with their version, even though they've had some. They've had injuries, they have people out, they've had suspensions. Like, they've had to deal with some things. But okay, teams are kind of taking a shot at your success. Both those teams, the key for them is they both travel well. Like, what they do does good on the road. I don't necessarily think that I would hand over the Celtics being the top team, but they've earned the right to be in that conversation. And I think the thing you have to realize about the Eastern Conference, these playoffs are going to be, it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a back and forth. It's going to be really tough to deal with, because you can look at these standings and we can see the good in a whole lot of these teams. Now, for some of you, you may stop at a certain point, right? Like Detroit, we know what they do. Boston, we know what they do. The Knicks, we know when they play at a high level, it's really tough to deal with. Cleveland, James Harden, we know what their ceiling is. Toronto, you might start to raise an eyebrow, but they are annoying defensively and can find ways to win. And now you have the Orlandos of the world, where Orlando very secretly has won 7 of their last 10 games. And Okay, do you actually want to deal with Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner in a playoff series with that defense, with a playoff game plan? The Miami Heat have won 8 of their last 10 games. Do you actually want to deal with this team that believes in themselves offensively at 150%, even if you don't think they can score? We're going to score points, just so you know, and we might throw a zone at you. The Sixers have been the metronome for most of the year at 6, right? And now you look in and they're in the play-in now. And we'll talk about them in a little bit, but it's like, okay, we've seen the highs, we're now seeing the lows. The Hawks and the Hornets, they're going to score points. The Hornets, both ends of the floor. Like, so this is where you're going to get teams that believe we can beat each other in a competitive environment. And that's what I think people are missing out on. With you, like, you should enjoy the Eastern Conference, especially that first round. That second round is going to be a mess because it's just going to be a brawl. But the competitive nature of these teams that have success, have some weaknesses, but there's not a team you can point to in the Eastern Conference that doesn't think they can beat each other.
Yeah, man, having a ton of fun with the Eastern Conference right now. And I told you the Southeast Division was going to be fun, but we'll leave that there. We're going to take a quick break. One, I want to talk about how awesome the Nuggets Thunder game last night was. Shea versus Jokic was a knockout brawl. And then we're going to circle back to the Eastern Conference. We want to check the concern levels of the Detroit Pistons and the Philadelphia 76ers as they deal with their recent slides. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spy. And Steve, before we circle back to the Eastern Conference, oh my goodness, Thunder Nuggets. What a basketball game that was. Two of the best teams in the Western Conference, two of the best teams in the NBA, especially when they are healthy. This was, as we talked about, 2 games of Jason Tatum. This is also the second game in the return of Aaron Gordon. And buddy, did he make his presence felt very early on in that basketball game. But Nuggets still not completely healthy, and the Thunder were missing Chet and Isaiah Hartenstein and Jalen Williams and Alex Caruso. And it ends up being a 129-126 victory for the Oklahoma City Thunder in this one. Shai ties the Wilt record for most consecutive regular season games with at least 20 points and hits the game-winning three with 2.7 left. Nikola Jokic with yet another triple-double, and he was absolutely nuts in the second half of that basketball game. And so, broadly speaking, Steve, I'll start with this question. Did you feel like we learned anything about this game, or was it just a great game?
I mean, I think it was a great game. I think there's always an opportunity to learn things. And I think when you look at Denver and OKC, for Denver, the lesson has to be we don't have a large margin for error in this matchup, but we can do some things against this team. And if you're OKC, we're a machine on both ends of the floor, and you have to deal with us. And so I think OKC being able to have the knowledge of, yes, we have our two bigs that are very good, but we also can play small against this team and we can do different things defensively. But it was such a back and forth battle in a way that I just don't know if it's being appreciated as much, because I think sometimes if you're a fan of a team, you can kind of really get in that bubble mode, right? Where it's like, okay, I have this feeling about my team. I'm going to talk about my team in a certain way. I'm not going to appreciate necessarily the things they did because they lost. I understand that portion. Denver did a lot of good things defensively as far as being able to work to give multiple efforts, to have rotations, to keep Jokic low, to switch and, you know, help on drives. Like, they had a lot of good reps and a lot of good possessions. OKC's just so good that they're not going to stop. You know, I think that's kind of the thing that we've seen with the Thunder this season is an understanding and a confidence what they do offensively to continue to attack. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, very quickly, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was outstanding in that game. He's been great all year. But if you're going to sit here and say the Oklahoma City Thunder win because of their defense or win because of anything, you are underrating what Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has to do on every single night and the ability and skill that he has to get to whatever spot he wants to get to on the court and make a shot. If you want to talk about push-offs, you want to talk about foul drawing, talk about the other half as well. Because what he does is not easy. And Denver was working to try and show help, show doubles. And Shai having just kind of the moments where he said, actually, I'm just going to drive, straight line drive, finish. I can get to my step back two whenever I want. The step back three counter, especially you saw late in the game. What do you do with that? Because, okay, we're not doubling. I'm not going all the way to the rim. I'm going to get whatever I want. That puts pressure on you. On the flip side, it's always interesting with Denver, the moments where a team decides, hey, Nikola Jokic, we're going to ask you to score the basketball. And he decides to deliver on that and says, actually, I would like to score the basketball. I'm going to several times in a row. And that third quarter where they just said, you know what, Nikola Jokic, bring the ball up the court, wing pick and roll. Let's see what they do and let's play out of it. And we'll get a roll every now and then. If we get a switch, you get a catch, you drive. You put pressure on this team. If you're going to stay at home, cool. If you and he scores in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable about it, right? Like it's unconventional. You feel bad about it. And it's like, okay, I need to show help. And the minute you show help, the ball is gone. So you just don't feel good about any of the decisions that you've made. And I think that's the beauty of that back and forth. And also, it was a very good bit from David Adelman to start the fourth quarter with Nikola Jokic, but only for a minute. Hey, don't worry about the non-Jokic minutes, man. He's going to stay on the court. And then they played well, and he took him out and then gave him a little bit of rest. So there's a balancing act. I think Denver's trying to figure out their rotation to a degree with Aaron Gordon back and trying to figure out the best lineups and, okay, when do we play JV? Who do we play together? How do we get the most out of Christian Brown and Cam Johnson? Like, I think that you learned a lot about where they need to go if you're Denver, right? If you're Oklahoma City, you learn that you need to keep trusting in what you do on both ends of the floor. So it was a really, really fun game.
Oh, man. Okay, I want to hang on Denver for a minute because as you were talking about what they did in the third quarter to get Jokic's touches, very quickly on that front, because I was watching that game like, oh, my goodness, OKC just does not have an answer for this. Like, he's Nikola Jokic, so you don't really have answers for him anyway. But when you're factoring in, you don't have the shot blocking and the overall length of Chet. You don't have just the literal bulk of Isaiah Hartenstein. Jalen Williams is doing his best, and he had himself one heck of a game. I think career high 7 made threes in that one. So I don't want to diminish him. He is just smaller than Jokic. And so it's just like, well, we don't want to give up cuts, or we don't give up catch and shoot threes. We're just going to battle and maybe show some late help. And Nikola Jokic in that like 5 to 10 foot range, just sprinkle again, shot after shot after shot after shot. Maybe look it up after the game once things updated on Second Spectrum, Steve. So the league average on shots between 5 and 10 feet, talk about like literal like floater range, the league average is 44%. Nikola Jokic converts 59% of those shots on some of the highest volume in the league. What in blazes do you do with a guy that is bigger than you, can make any pass in the book, and because he's bigger than you, he can shoot over you, and is over 15 percentage points above league average in that range? A shot that you quote-unquote want to give up because you don't want to give up threes, you don't want to give up shots at the rim. What do you do with that? The answer in that third quarter was largely nothing. The other thing I wanted to point on with Denver going to the first quarter, I was so annoyed. It's funny that we have a picture of Jokic and Lou Dort on. This is just basketball brain, so excuse me. The Nuggets ran Chicago action what felt like 30 times in that first quarter, and Lou Dort got clipped on every single one of them. And I'm just like, how is this not being defended better than it is? Before you even get into like how good Jokic is, how good Jamal Murray is, et cetera, I'm just like, how are y'all getting blasted on this every time down? It is Jokic in the middle of the floor. We are going to have Christian Brown set an off-ball screen for Jamal Murray to come off a handoff. And it felt like Lou Dort was just not ready for it anytime they ran it. Like, you have seen this team 40 times over the last 12 months. I just didn't get that part. But anyway, fantastic back and forth to your point, Steve. And circling back to Shea for a moment, 35 points, 15 assists. You don't see those games very often. You don't see 35 very often. You don't see 15 assists very often. You don't see that in the same game very often. To do that with zero turnovers at the same time is insane. And to do that with zero turnovers, with how often, to your earlier point, Steve, the Nuggets were like, nope, we're putting two on the ball. Oh, you have crossed half court. We are sending a second defender towards you. Oh, you're trying to get into the straight line drive without a screen. Nope, we are showing bodies. I posted a screenshot at the end of the first quarter.
You're a screenshot? You're a screenshot poster now? Come on, man.
We do a little bit of both. You got to be versatile these days in HD.
But no, I posted a screenshot. No, absolutely not. I'm not letting you do that off. Stop posting screenshots. Is that how basketball works?
Of course it isn't how basketball works. That's why you always post. You also post the video. But I laughed at how Denver was loading up before Shea wanted to attack at the end of the first quarter. I think it's Christian Brown that had the assignment. It's like Jokic above the three-point line from the strong side corner. It's somebody else kind of lurking ready to double. It's just like, you're showing this while he is standing at half court before the drive. And then the drive actually happens, and they're like trying to flood him, of course. And it's another kick for him at the end of the first. And it's just like, you're seeing this amount of defensive attention, and you put together that game and cap off that game with that shot, or those shots, rather. It was one of my favorite games of the season overall. But if you're talking about individual performances, what Jokic and Shea did in that game was incredible. But Shea slammed the door. It was unbelievable. Can I ask you a question?
Can I say something before you ask me the question?
Yes, you can.
Because I have a Denver thought, and I think that it's not been a fun few weeks if you're a Denver Nugget fan, right? There's been some losses that have stacked up, probably not feeling the best about it. You fall into the sixth seed after having a metronome of a year. You're in a weird place where you're just not winning at home anymore. Like, you're 17-13. You got the same home record as the Los Angeles Clippers. Like, that's probably not what you anticipated. But one thing I will say, if you look at who they've played and what they've faced, right? They've had to face, Cleveland, the Clippers, Golden State, Oklahoma City twice, Minnesota, New York, the Lakers. You have tested your defense and tried different things as far as doubling and showing Jokic on the baseline and do we want to double there? Working to keep Jokic low, switching. You've had to implement different things defensively. And so have the reps gone as well as you want consistently? Probably not. I wouldn't argue that. But you have had the reps. And so this could be a moment where this adversity pays off down the line, because okay, we've workshopped different things. We workshopped different lineups. We workshopped different schemes. We workshopped trapping and pick and roll. We workshopped being in a drop. We workshopped Jokic on a non-shooter, keeping him low. We've workshopped switching and rotating. And does that help them long-term, even if it's hurting them right now, is where it gets interesting for me.
Okay. Well, Steve, we have been doing this podcast for way too long, because my question for you was going to be, hey, how did you feel about Nikola Jokic on Lu Dort and some of the different looks that they tossed out with him in that game? And so as you go into that, I don't feel like I actually need to ask you that question, because you kind of already answered it. So salute to you. So salute to you on that front.
I think to answer your question that you're not asking, I think it's about Denver being able to do multiple things and having different things in their back pocket. And I think there were a couple of possessions where they really did a good job of switching and rotating and recovering and helping each other. It's just the amount of times you have to do that, and can you consistently nail the multiple efforts? And so that was probably my bigger thing. Like, okay, they're going to have to be this, and that matchup against Houston gets real fascinating real quick. But go ahead, Nikias.
Okay, well, I guess just to quickly pivot, I'll circle back to Aaron Gordon, who finished with 23-10 in this game. He had 19 points in the first quarter, and it was a very loud example of, one, just how good and important Aaron Gordon is, and two, how problematic he is in this particular matchup. Because I think the one thing, at least that I've consistently said on this podcast, as I have been very high on the OKC experience, has been, hey, they don't really have, if there's one thing they don't have, they don't really have like the 6'7", 6'8", bulky forward power defender type. Gosh darn it. They don't really have that mold of player, at least not consistently in their rotation. And so Aaron Gordon comes back, and OKC starts the game with Lu Dort on Jamal Murray, the Chicago action reps notwithstanding. And they had Cason Wallace on Aaron Gordon. And immediately I was like, ooh, we are going to get some duck ins from Aaron Gordon. And that may be problematic for the OKC defense, especially since they have Jalen Williams on Jokic, and he's also smaller than Jokic. I did not anticipate this being the Aaron Gordon shot making plus Aaron Gordon cuts plus the Aaron Gordon duck in. Like, the back-to-back threes from Aaron Gordon to kind of cap a run in the first quarter, I was like, oh, he's just doing this. Like, Aaron Gordon is just a good shooter now. It's just kind of wild. And so it was cool to kind of see that example of this is what he provides. This is why he is so important to what Denver does on both ends of the floor. For that matter, like, he was part of the help being shown for Denver's defense, some of the switching they were able to tap into as well. But, like, it was very loud, hey, welcome back, Aaron Gordon. You are dominating this matchup. But then the other three quarters happened. And so very quickly, 19 points, 3 of 4 on twos, 2 of 2 on threes, 6 of 7 from the line in the first quarter. Rest of the game, 4 points, 1 of 6 inside the arc with some very interesting pull-up attempts coming early in the clock there. Did not make a three, still perfect from the line, but just wasn't the same bit. So they do need a level of consistency for him. And so just kind of balancing, be aggressive because you can take advantage of matchups, and also, hey, we still want to be us holistically. But again, that's more of a single game thing than, like, I'm worried Aaron Gordon's going to hijack the offense or something ridiculous like that. But I want to salute Aaron Gordon on that front. And also, welcome back A.J. Mitchell. Just having another guy that can get downhill and attack tilted defenses or do the tilting of defenses. I think he was very important off the bench in his return. Had not played in, I think, 20 games. 24 off the bench. I think you take that, every Oklahoma City Thunder. Especially if Shea is going to see the amount of help and the amount of doubles that he got in that game. Just having another pressure relief guy was very important for them. So I wanted to salute them. Can I ask you a narrative E question, Steve?
Sure.
Did this game swing the MVP discussion for you in any real way?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I still have my list. Like, I had Shea for the majority of the year. So it didn't really, there's nothing really to swing to a degree. Yeah, sorry. Did it swing it for you, man?
Not really. And I feel like we've had conversations across years on the pod where, like, I don't really care that much about head-to-head matchups when it comes to the MVP discussion. Like, that is very low on my list. And I feel like I'm in the minority on that front. I'm just like, we have 82 games.
Sure are. Yeah, but I played this one game and I took it to you. My trophy.
Yeah. Like, I'm just like, this was nice. This is like one of 82, or if like, depending on the candidate, like one of 78 or whatever the number ends up being. It's way less important to me than it is to the majority of folks. And I own that. That's fine. And so to answer your question, like, no, it didn't swing it for me. But I did see a lot of the Shea hits that game winner. Like, oh, nah, this is just his. If you had any question about Jokic taking it over for him, whatever, this is it. And I always look at things like, okay, what if Shea has like 17 in the next game and Jokic has another 30-point triple-double? Like, does that then mean like it's, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't like the same.
It's a different game. They're not playing each other. I have a question for you. How many games can Shea miss to stay eligible?
Not too many. I think like 7 or something like that. I can get that quickly though. But he is still eligible. He is on pace for eligibility. So like, I don't, you know. It does get funny if he becomes ineligible. Jokic, I think, still not on pace yet. As you know, I track the have you played 79% of your team's games yet. So like, Jokic still not in right now.
Shea, you sure do. You've been real quiet. You've been real silent about that, huh?
If you want my awards,
no, I don't. But I want to talk about the Eastern Conference. You're real quiet as people been jumping you low key. I didn't see you defend that 65 game rule this year. They're real quiet from the Kai's Duncan.
I think it's fine. I understand why people are angry about it. A lot of people just didn't like it to begin with, and so now that Jokic, Wemby, like Luka gets hazy, it's like, hey, why are we doing this? I'm just like, well, this is just kind of what happens when you don't play games. So like, I haven't felt the need to say a whole bunch of stuff, but like that's where we're at. Anyway, we'll move to the Eastern Conference though. That's fine. So Steve, let's talk about these Detroit Pistons, shall we? So overall this year, 45-18, they still had the best record in the Eastern Conference, though their lead over the Boston Celtics is shrinking, which, brief aside, if we're going to post quotes, can we use the full quote and not try to make controversy out of things that are not controversial? JB Bickerstaff saying, Boston is good. I'm not worried about them. I am worried more about us and us taking care of business. Does not mean that he is disrespecting the Boston Celtics. Don't cut off the... Anyway, that's fine. Anyway, Detroit Pistons, best record in the Eastern Conference, 11th in offense, second in defense, fourth in net rating. What's up?
Did you get annoyed on the internet again? Do I need to bring the hashtag Big Mag back? Do you need to bring this back?
We ain't got to do a full blown. I don't like disingenuous stuff, man. I don't like that. Like people misunderstand things sometimes, and that's what conversation and insight is for. I don't like, here are three sentences. If I take off the third sentence, the feeling of this thought is way different and more scandalous. So let's use the first two sentences instead. I don't like stuff like that. That bothers me. Don't do that.
Okay.
But back to the actual basketball of the Detroit Pistons.
Mm-hmm.
They are on, as you alluded to, it's not like they haven't lost all that often, and they certainly haven't strung together losses all that often. They have lost four straight games. Lost at Cleveland, at San Antonio. They lost to Brooklyn at home, in which they had a big lead and lost it. And then on the second leg of that back-to-back, they lost to the Miami Heat. No Cade or Sar in the Brooklyn game. No Sar in the Miami game. We're waiting on Sar Thompson to come back. He is very important to what the Detroit Pistons do defensively. He has had an all-defense caliber year. And even as he has some offensive questions that we talked about with Kuka Hill on a recent episode of Dunker Spot, like the offensive rebounding is still important, the cutting is still important, the transition attacks are still important, so et cetera. Missing a Sar is a big deal. Just wanted to sprinkle that in. But they've lost four straight. They are 5-5 since the All-Star break, where they have been pretty much middle of the pack in everything. Since then. So over those 10 games, 17th in offense, 15th in defense, 15th in net rating per NBA.com. And so, Steve, the question I pose to you is this just a blip for the Detroit Pistons late in the season? They faced adversity. They're ultimately going to be fine. Or has there been anything during this stretch of games where you're like, ooh, they may need to solve this or this could be a bigger deal?
You know what I'm going to say. It's the adversity of the season. You know, I don't want to tell the full story, but I was in Brooklyn 10 years ago, good Lord, long time ago. And the Brooklyn Nets were not having a good year on my way out. And we play the Cleveland Cavaliers in March with LeBron James, and we beat them in the Barclays Center. And I sat in the background. I was like, who says this team is a contender? Well, they went and made history and made a historic comeback against the Warriors, won the championship that year. So, yeah, things happen in March. You got to deal with it. This is the adversity of the season. I think the biggest thing when it comes to Detroit, right, the defense hasn't been at the same level. You could say they're 5-5 post All-Star break. They beat New York. Mm-hmm. They beat Cleveland. They beat Orlando. Mm-hmm. So they've had some good positive performances post All-Star break. They also have had to deal with Victor Wembanyama twice. That's not exactly fun, specifically for that team. Cleveland sure got their revenge back on them. Brooklyn, you know, guys were out, but they were ended up putting themselves in a position to win. They ended up losing that one. And Miami is scorching hot. The defense, it's just a reminder. I think their defense has to play at a certain level for them to have a certain amount of success. Like, that's a non-negotiable, I think, for the Pistons. You have to be able to defend and guard. You can't give up 120 a night, and you can't let up on that end. You just don't have the wiggle room. So I think for me, that's the biggest reminder. And then offensively, you just got to maintain your sharpness, maintain your attack, get the ball in the paint, move and attack defenses. That's the biggest thing for me. There are certain things, like, I think we get so caught up in what a team doesn't do. Like, oh, this team is uncreative. You don't understand the amount of creativity you have to have when you are lacking things offensively, when you don't have natural spacers, when you don't have multiple people who can just get a bucket. Like, you have to generate and create so many different things to open the possibility for you to run and execute and put pressure on defenses, because you don't have the, oh, we can just space the floor and run a pick and roll. No, we don't have that. Like, so many things work for certain teams. We can't just copy and paste that to our team. We don't have the personnel for that. If you defend the first part of this play, we're going to be cooked. So I think you got to, like, we kind of copy and stop copying and pasting the creativity portion. You got to be real creative to try and figure out how to score when you can't score sometimes. That's my biggest thing.
And even when you can, like, the Thunder have been a top five offense this year. They were a top five offense last year. And we had similar, hey, man, if Shea ain't on the floor, what does this look like? If you take away some of this pick and roll, or you just trap Shea, what does this look like? And that's with just a top five offense. You know what I mean? So, like, to your general point, it's just kind of hard to score in the NBA, which kind of goes against the there's no defense being played thing. But again, we'll save that rant for another day. I think to answer my own question, Steve, with Detroit, I think this is, like, I'd say it's like 65% just adversity, and they're fine as they get healthier, at least to close out the regular season. And it's 35%. Ooh, this is kind of what I've been concerned about with Detroit, as much as I've enjoyed them. Like, the one thing that I've been able to point at is less the creativity bit and more to, you know, what you said, like the spacing and how we have to kind of work around that. And it's when you face good teams / good defenses / good coaching staffs, are you going to be able to generate enough offense in the half court? And I think, honestly, this is kind of where the Asar portion comes back in. Because I think with Detroit, they have been hovering around the top 10 offense all year long. But it reminds me of kind of the peak Memphis teams with Ja, which sounds wild to say, like, peak Memphis at this point, since Bane's not there, Jaren's not there anymore, et cetera. But you looked at some of the Memphis teams, like, oh, this is a top 10 offense. And then you look at their splits, and it's, oh, they get out in transition more than just about anyone. The half-court offense is kind of mid. But because they run as much as they do, it equals an overall top 10 offense. Detroit has a similar bit. I think they're 18th in half-court offense, but third highest transition rate in the league, and they're about league average there, but that's still a lot of points per possession. This is where their offense is hovering around the top 10. You remove Asar Thompson out of the mix, and thus the guy that really helps you with the weak side blocks, the weak side steals, the on-ball steals. They get you into transition. Oh, we don't get as many of those baskets as we're accustomed to. We're in the half-court more. The other quiet thing about Detroit, their half-court offensive rating is what it is. In terms of the percentage of possessions that are spent in the half-court, they got the lowest mark in the league this year. So again, further emphasizes, like, we get out, we force turnovers, we force misses, we get out and run. If the defense slips at all, you lose part of that. And now if you're in the half-court more, this is where teams, you look at the Spurs game, okay, let's put Wimby on a non-shooter, let's just muck stuff up. And even if you just kind of broaden out the scope post All-Star break, with Cade and Jalen Duren. All right, they're in action. We know how good Cade is. We know how good Jalen Duren is. Okay, let's switch this and show a whole bunch of help behind it. Let's just put two on Cade all the time and then pre-rotate Jalen Duren and dare somebody else to shoot. Like, they're mixing up the types of help and the type of aggression against those two. And now there's even more of a spotlight on, the others around those two, where it's like, hey, y'all kind of have to make shots. You kind of have to make plays in order for this to work. Like, even circling back to the Cleveland win that they had during the stretch, Steve. One, like, Cleveland had them in a box for a majority of that game. And then the fourth quarter and overtime happens, and shout out Dennis Jenkins, and shout out Jalen. Like, they got plays, and they ultimately won that game. They deserve credit for that. But even in that game, you kind of saw, ooh, we can just kind of muck things up. We can take the pain away from you. You kind of have to solve that. And so that's where I'm like, I don't think Detroit is fraudulent, like, or anything like that. This is where, again, I am more so, this is adversity, and I think they're ultimately going to be fine. But it is starting to get a little bit louder about, okay, when they are in the half court, they do need more answers to this. Even if it isn't more creativity, some of y'all just have to knock down the open shots that you're getting to kind of grease the wheels a little bit so we can get back to leading with our defense, forcing those misses, forcing those turnovers, and then being the best version of ourselves.
You fell into my trap, guys, Duncan. Here's the thing. But the concern that you have with Detroit, if I was to be concerned, is if they could not create shots. The fact that they can still create the looks they want to and they're missing them tells me, okay, we just need to make shots. When a team becomes in peril, to me, it's when we are no longer able to create the kind of looks we want to. And I have not felt that with Detroit. I know they've not made the kind of shots we want to make. I know they haven't felt the way they felt offensively before, but at no point has it felt like, boy, they can't do anything. We're unable to create offense. Until they get to that point, I'm not concerned. So there we go.
I think that's fair. And like, not me falling into the trap card. That's crazy. But I think that's fair. I guess for me, it's more like, if you're taking away the paint from Cade and from Durin, like, it puts a lot of emphasis on Cade to, like, okay, you have to make all these middies. You have to be more willing to take pull-up threes and knock those down. Like, not that he's not capable, but again, it just kind of shifts a little bit of responsibility. And the role players just have to knock down shots to grease the wheel. So we will see. Again, we'll see if they're able to snap this losing streak relatively soon. Last thing for me, Steve, I just wanted to quickly touch on the Sixers. Not going to do full deep dive. We got some other stuff to get to. But the Sixers are 1-4 in March right now. And as you mentioned earlier, they've kind of been firmly in the 4-6 range pretty much all year long until we got to this stretch. And now they have fallen to 8th. Clean the glass, they are 16th in offense, 18th in defense, 19th in net rating, negative point differential right now, despite being 4 games over .500. And in those games, to give a little bit of grace to them off rip, which kind of flows into my overall question for you, Joel Embiid has not played in March, and he's missed 8 of their last 10 games. Tyrese Maxey currently out with a sprained pinky finger, which, quick shout out to Derek Bodner of Philly Sports, PHLY Sports, who recently noted, like, hey, Tyrese dealt with this finger injury last year, and then the 4 games that he played trying to work through the sprained pinky, shot 28% from the field, I think went 2-1-4. They ultimately shut him down, and ultimately Philly was just shutting people down anyway. They end up with Vijay Edgecombe. I think they won that one. But if Maxey's going to play through this one, we do have that bit of recent history there. Kelly Oubre missed the San Antonio, Utah back-to-back. Paul George is still suspended. So, like, they're missing folks right now. They are 20th in offense, 20th in defense, 21st in net rating since the All-Star break. And my broader thing I want to pose to you, Steve, is, like, I don't know how to analyze this portion of the Sixers season. Not that I can't, like, turn on the game and see what they're doing on offense and defense, because, like, you can see that stuff. But more so, bigger picture, I entered the season saying to you, my only guarantee about the Sixers season is that I'm going to be wrong about the Sixers season. I'm either going to trust in the talent and think they're going to be like a top 4 seed and they're going to finish like 12th, or I'm not going to trust the health and then they're going to. And lo and behold, they're now 8th. So, like, that's lovely. And so it's just like, I don't know how to soak in the fact that we have seen the high end of the Sixers with Joel Embiid flowing in into December, into January, and looking like a world ender. Tyrese Maxey has played an all-NBA level and fringe MVP candidate pretty much all year long. Vijay Edgecombe has firmly been, he's going to be make the all-rookie first team. We're going to get there a little bit later. But, like, he's been good. Paul George was starting to find his way as kind of like a gap filler on both ends of the floor before his suspension. And you were getting enough from, like, the second unit guys. And Kelly Oubre was having a good year. It's like, okay, this is what it can look like. And then we get here where guys are missing. Teams are throwing different looks at Tyrese Maxey. It's like, okay, this feels interesting. I just don't know which part to believe in, I guess, because the health stuff was always in peril. So, like, the question I wanted to ask you on a general note is just, like, how have you soaked in this Sixers season? And then to narrow it down, how have you felt about this Sixers stretch? Because, like, I don't know how much to weigh because of how perilous the health situation is with them.
I mean, I think for me, this portion of the Sixers season is we cannot afford this. We've run out of things to be able to handle the adversity that we're being handed. I think for me, overall, Philadelphia did a very good job of building a type of offense that would highlight Tyrese Maxey, highlight BJ Edgecombe as they were trying to get Paul George and Joel Embiid back. So, okay, we're not going to do elbow action. We're not going to be post heavy. We're going to get to drive and kick. We're going to get to flow. We're going to get to cuts. We're going to have this. So we have something on top of what Joel Embiid brings to the table. And we saw Joel Embiid come back and stabilize. So we have the drive and kick, but also we can play through Joel Embiid at the elbow. We can play through him at the post. He can do pick and roll. He can do handoffs. We can keep pressure on you that way. So you had kind of the yin and the yang to a degree of, okay, we've built something when we're trying to manage him. He comes in and elevates that. Paul George finds his rhythm in that. And then everyone starts to disappear. Joel Embiid is now gone again. And I mean gone. Paul George is out. BJ Edgecombe is out. And now you're left with a talent deficit to a degree that can't overcome, you know, because it's cool to do drive and kick and to do cuts and flow. But if you're a team facing Philadelphia 76ers, why am I not just switching everything? Who am I scared about here? So I become easier to guard to a degree. So it's less about, hey, what can Philadelphia do? It's more, can they get their people on the court now, because they have put themselves in a position at six to, okay, we can compete. You don't want to see us in the playoffs. At eight, that's a different story.
And even with eight, they're what, a game and a half ahead of, like, they're closer to nine than they are to six at this point. It's like, if this skid continues, if these guys continue to miss, like, what happens if the Sixers continue to slide? Like, the next five games, they're playing Memphis later tonight. On Thursday, they go to Detroit. Saturday against Brooklyn, which they should win, but, like, Brooklyn plays a style to where if Philly doesn't have, like, Embiid back in particular, like, the Sixers get up, I mean, the Nets get up and down, and they can force turnovers. And so, like, that could get kind of hazy. Like, stylistically, that's an interesting matchup. Portland, similar deal, especially if they are any semblance of healthy. Like, the Portland slide, we talk about the West playing, like, that's kind of gone under-discussed, but that's okay. but, yeah, that's where I'm just kind of, like, I agree with you, but it also feels to me like I don't want to sell the Sixers short. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to reduce them to, if healthy, good, if not healthy, bad. And that's just kind of it. You know what I mean? So that's why I'm just kind of like, how are you soaking this part in? Because, like, I'm watching these Sixers games. Like, to your point, it was Cleveland on the second night of a back-to-back. They had no Maxey. They had no Embiid. They had no PG. They had no VJ. And so Cleveland very largely was like, yeah, we're just switching all of this stuff, actually. And, like, unless you force a miss or a turnover, you can actually get into some of this early drag stuff and be able to get downhill that way. You don't really, you don't have anything. It's like, okay. And then the defense itself is, they're missing their best guys. I guess the last thing I'll note before we get out of here, like, I would like to see more consistency from Quentin Grimes. Like, that would certainly help this iteration of the team. And once everyone comes back, you get a more consistent scoring punch for him. It feels like the productivity and the way that they're using him has kind of fluctuated throughout the year. And so I want to see more on that. He just had, I think, 26 the other night, and that was his first 20-point game since December 5th. I don't know if that's the kind of note you want with Quentin Grimes, but it's just odd. I hope they're able to get it together. But it's just been kind of odd watching the Sixers and watching the bodies kind of drop on that point. That's all I had. All right, well, we're going to take a break there. When we return, Steve has another edition of his rookie ranking, so we're going to sort through those. And then we're going to check back in on the rookie awards. Who's the rookie of the year? Who's going to be in that top three? And what do our all-rookie teams look like as of March 10th? We still have another month or so to go. We want to check in real quick. So please stay tuned. Continue to rock with us. And we are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot. And Steve, while we're, I guess, loosely related to the Philadelphia 76ers, let's talk some rookies. Let's talk VJ Edgecombe and the rest of the top of this class. You recently wrote another rookie ranking, which was very well done. Check it out on Yahoo Sports if you haven't already. Steve's been dropping these monthly. It's been cool to kind of see him one, just you write. So just a brief aside, like I have enjoyed reading your content all year long. So please keep it going, friend. But second, let's dig into these rookies. Let's get into your top five as of today, Steve. So who do you have in your top five right now?
Well, I think the most interesting thing before we even get to the top five is just at this point of the year, you know a lot about these rookies. Like, you've seen a lot of their success, you've seen the highs and lows, you've seen consistency be shown, you've seen reps pay off, you've seen like roles grow, everything's kind of established to a point. So you have probably more answers than questions, but you don't have the complete story still. And it gets really interesting to me as I was putting this together. It's like, okay, how do we balance this rookie of the year race where Cooper Flagg and Colin Knipple have had incredible seasons? And they've just kind of passed things back and forth, probably. There's some people that probably have had Con number one the whole time. There's some people that have maybe switched to Cooper Flagg. Some people that have gone back and forth. And I think it gets interesting when you look at the two players in particular. Like, Colin Knipple has just been a metronome as far as his consistency for the Charlotte Hornets. You know exactly what you're going to get for him. He has a base that helps them offensively. He's scoring and shooting has been outstanding, and it's been just like hard to deny how great he's been every single night for this team. But then you kind of balance that out with Cooper Flagg and his incredible growth over the course of the season, where we go from the start of the season, we're talking about, hey, is he making the right reads? Is he finding his way offensively? And now you see a command and a control offensively, a consistency, a confidence where I'm going to get to whatever spot I want. We're going to run pick and roll. I'm going to get downhill. I'm going to left hand hezzy and drive, and whoever's here, you got to deal with me. How do you balance that out? You know, Colin Knipple is helping to impact Charlotte's winning. Cooper Flagg is handling a super large responsibility and workload for a Dallas offense that needs him to make these plays and make these reads. So how do we get that done? And then as we go further down, especially, you know, going to the top five, even going to the top 10, how do we deal with injuries, right? How do we digest a rookie's full season versus how they're playing towards the end? Like, how do we handle Derek Queen and Jeremiah Fears and the shifts for them? How do we handle a Maxime Renard or Ace Bailey having more of an opportunity to produce, but what's happening with that opportunity? And so I think it's just a lot of good players in different situations having impactful moments, and it gets interesting for me. So that's where I would start, guys. Sorry.
Oh, okay. No, I think that's fair. And I think to the actual five names that you had, like, I think it's kind of like six players for five spots. For like that top five, in my opinion. And we're going to get there as we get to the rookie discussion. But Colin Knipple, Cooper Flagg, VJ Edgecombe, I feel like that's kind of been our top three in some order for pretty much the entire season. To your point, some may have had Cooper Flagg shifted to Con or had Con shifted to Cooper. Some may have had either one of those just number one overall for however you, whatever your format is. VJ's just kind of been three. Where you come out the gate, like, yeah, sure, I'll log 38 minutes a game and defend the opposing player's best perimeter guy because you need us to do that, especially while Paul George is working himself back into flow. And here are the drives and transition attacks, and here's the three-point shooting. It's like, oh, well, he's helping a winner. That's cool. Honestly, to that portion, Steve, like, role versus impacting a good team or impacting winning overall, it's kind of been interesting to watch, like, the VJ and Con cases, because, like, when VJ was really at the peak of I am scoring, I'm driving, I'm shooting, I'm defending. The Sixers are surprised, like, they're in the top four, top five. The Hornets weren't this yet. You know what I mean? Like, Con was still helping because of the shooting and the screening and the drives were hitting. But, like, you didn't have that element. You flipped to 2026, and now the Hornets have just been one of the best teams in basketball, and Con keeps doing this. It's like, oh, well, this feels even louder. We're watching, you know, collectively as the NBA community, we're watching Charlotte more because how are they doing this? There's no way they keep doing this. Oh, they keep doing this. And within that, Colin Knipple has just kept doing this. And to your point about Cooper Flagg, it's just like, okay, point guard experiment. There's a lot of on-ball reps, the space rate. He's trying to figure out the mid-range game. But, like, you still felt an element of he seems comfortable getting to spots. Defensively, he can do a little bit of everything on and off the ball. There are growth areas defensively. But, like, overall, there's a baseline level of he is not going to hurt us. And at the best version of himself is he is flying around defensively. And so now, like, before you get to this Cooper Flagg injury, and thank goodness he just came back on Thursday, it was like, oh, snap, Cooper might actually overtake this. Like, he's been insane. But then he got hurt. And so whatever, I think that's where I think a rookie of the year, like, I have kind of been on the con train. But now you factor in, oh, Coop just missed so much time. There's even more ground for him to cover as we close out this season. So, like, I'm curious to see how that part plays out. Like, it is a 12-game gap between the two right now.
Here's the thing, though. Like, I had Cooper Flagg one the last time I did these. And he had the injury. Khan was consistent. It felt like Khan just kind of snuck up a little bit. But you look and you got to remember how good Cooper Flagg was playing before the injury. Like, he would score 27 or more in five of his last six games before he got hurt. And he was starting to make threes. He was starting to get to the free throw line. And it was like, okay, he's found a different level. And then he got hurt. And while he got hurt, Colin Knipple's just like, hey, I'm just going to keep doing what I do, which is make a whole bunch of threes, set screen, slip, roll, finish, and be a metronome. BJ Edgecombe, I think it's easy to call him just like a distant third, but he's been a consistent third, in my opinion. And
that's a bar. You
know, we just talked about the Sixers, but they're not necessarily like this version of this team without his efforts and his consistency and his ability to get downhill and understand the assignment and mix in the threes and the makes. Statistically, are there a ton of numbers that you can just point to and be like, hey, this is great? Maybe not. But he's asked to do something that's not easy. Hey, can you make a bunch of shots for us? And can you make a bunch of plays for us? And can you defend at a high level? And you see what they look like without him. And so I salute BJ Edgecombe for just having an understanding of what the assignment is and being able to do this consistently as a rookie. Like, that's not easy to do. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think if you want one number, Steve, just kind of looking at dunks and threes, EPM among the rookie class, BJ Edgecombe. He is fourth behind Colin Knipple, who's one, Colin Murray-Boyles, Cedric Cowart, VJ Edgecombe, among players that have played at least 45 games. Wanted to have like some kind of baseline there. But he's fourth there, and he's second overall in estimated wins. Khan's one, VJ's two, Cooper Flagg's three. So like there's some more advanced stuff to point to. But to your point, like his importance on both ends has just kind of been there. You can see that in the literal minute count. I don't think he would be playing as much if the Sixers didn't need him. And Nick Nurse in particular would not be playing him this much if he didn't need him. That's an extra level there. But I think once you get into 4, 5, 6, and again, that goes into the all-rookie second team, we're going to get there. I would assume that your top five is your all-rookie first team. That feels like a safe assumption.
Well, yeah. That's how these things should work. And in my opinion, your top five should be your top five. And so I think it's interesting because usually you don't always insert an impact on winning into an all-rookie case, right? Because typically, it's not always easy for a rookie to help a team immediately and impact their winnings. Sometimes the team is struggling. Dylan Harper, I think his case has just been the consistency and the strength as far as bouncing back from some tough months and continuing to kind of impact the Spurs. Like, the Spurs are at their best when they have their guards playing at a high level. And when he's able to get downhill, when he's able to get these paint touches, when he finishes, he forces help to create offense for San Antonio. It's so important. I think what he's done of late, it was really key because you kind of got to a point with Dylan Harper where it was like, ooh, our defense is just saying, make a play, man. If you're spaced, go ahead. We're gonna help off you. If you're not finishing, we're gonna contest. And his response, just to kind of be like, you know what? I'm gonna keep my poise. I'm gonna keep my pace. I'm gonna keep getting downhill. I'm gonna keep changing speeds. I'm gonna keep attacking in transition. Being a threat for a really good Spurs team, I think, is really key. And so I think that's why I put him four. After four, it got real interesting for me because what do you do with a Derek Queen? How do you process the shift for Derek Queen as far as what we saw early in the season, the potential, the passing, the playmaking, the smooth footwork, and then you look up and the minutes are different, the assists are slashed in half, and the defense doesn't feel as good as you would want it to at this stage in the season. So how do you balance that out? How do you appreciate the entire season that he's had? Because he still has a craft on his drives. He still is a really good playmaker and a passer. They're not necessarily playing through him at the same level. They're not playing him as many minutes. So how do we kind of respect and tip the cap to the efforts that he's done for the entirety of the season?
Yeah, like I think that's a fascinating question, Steve, because I think to your point about rookies impacting winning or having like positive on off and stuff like that, I think that should be, or I think historically had has been more of a, oh, if you do this, you get extra credit versus you have to impact winning at X amount of level. Otherwise, you're just not considered at all. Because as you said, it's kind of baked in. The top players in the draft are generally going to the worst teams in the league, or at least the year prior they were. There are obvious injury exceptions, things like that. But generally speaking, you're going to a bad team. You're supposed to lose your minutes. So when rookies are able to impact winning in a positive way and do so consistently, it's like, oh, well, this is special. So to your Dylan Harper point, him being this threat off the bench, and him being part of like this three guard or three and a half guard, however you want to designate Devin, being part of this wave, I think is pretty impressive, especially in this Western Conference. And so for Dylan Harper to bounce back, not just from teams saying, yeah, we're sitting on these drives, make jumpers, we dare you, also dealt with injury. Like, I think his injury stuff made this portion thing. The Cedric Coward injury made things interesting. As you think about it, you already talked about Derek Queen, his role kind of shifting, going to the bench. DeAndre Jordan's logging starts. Zion isn't missing games, which is a positive, but like that also complicates, ooh, how much do we want to play Zion and Derek Queen together? Offensively, this is intriguing. Defensively, it's just not tenable, at least not right now. So like that's an interesting subplot happening in New Orleans right now. But yeah, it's interesting. So what I did, Steve, is I went back to my notes. It's like, okay, what did I have when we did the last rookie check-in on, I think, January 23rd? And so my first team at that point was Cooper Flagg, Conn Knipple, VJ Edgecombe, Cedric Coward, and Derek Queen. Dylan Harper, who was like a first-team guy for me earlier in the year, because of the slide and the injuries, he slides to the second team for me. As of today, like Dylan Harper's probably back on my first team. Cedric Coward is kind of like the last guy in right now, as he like missed time, came back, and then he didn't play on Monday night. So we'll see if that, it was listed as knee management or knee injury management. So hopefully that's just precautionary versus something else being an issue. But like Cedric Coward's in, but like him versus Derek Queen, or just Harper versus Coward versus Queen, is kind of where I get to some friction within like, how do I want these teams to go? But first team for me, Conn, Flagg, VJ, Harper, Coward right now. As we get into the second team, Steve, so you had Derek Queen on your first team to cap that off. Who would you have on your second team right now?
Well, I had Cedric Coward was leading that off. And it's interesting because he's also someone who's very impactful for Memphis, but he's missed a lot of time. And so that's another person where how do we balance out what he's done throughout the season? Started out shooting the ball very well, struggled with the shot afterwards, but was able to continue to cut and drive and have an impact for Memphis, and then just missing a lot of time. Like, okay, I think you've been very impactful, but at some point, like everyone else is still kind of playing. What does that do? Struggle bus there. I have Maxime Reynaud, right? And so he's had an extended opportunity with Sacramento, and just being able to kind of be consistent and be a rim runner in transition and be a really good screener, like be solid, stay in the vision of, you know, whoever's handling the ball and so he can get a pocket pass. And so how much of this is just him being able to play minutes, or do we just kind of tip the cap because he's consistently producing? I had Jeremiah Fears next as well, which is, it's been an interesting deal for Jeremiah Fears, as far as you probably didn't anticipate him to be consistent. He showed a consistency early in the season, and then it just kind of went backwards a little bit. And so can he kind of find different ways to have impact? But I think it's, you know, the buck getting is one thing, but building on top of that is huge for him. Like, so having rejects and pick and roll, getting to drive and kick, like being ready off ball. I think he's kind of been a little bit cleaner as the season's gone on. So it's been a salute to Jeremiah Fears there. It's hard to deny what Colin Murray-Boyles has done all season for the Raptors. But again, he's also someone who
he's missed time.
So this is where it gets interesting. But I mean, when he's at the five, we know the impact he can have, but just the defensive importance, I think, that he's played with all season long. And, you know, there's not a ton of people you wouldn't trust him to guard. And so having that kind of energy and impact and consistency for a good team, that has value. And then for me, I have Ace Bailey last. I mean, I think he's found his comfort zone within what Utah's wanted to do offensively. And I think the movement has opened things up for him to get downhill, and he's found a way to be more consistent with that offensively. And so I think the willingness to kind of let it fly has been huge, but being able to do it on a nightly basis when teams are a little bit more prepared or a little bit more understanding of what you want to do offensively, I think that's important. So I think that would probably be my second team. You know, Coward, Raynell, Fears, Colin Murray-Boyles, and Ace Bailey.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're cycling through like the same groupings of names at the very least. So my second team as of today would be Derek Queen. I would have Maxime Raynaud in. Colin Murray-Boyles is still in, but I'm keeping an eye on the games. A guy that was on my second team when we did this worry, and I guess I will give my final shout out today since he's officially done for the season. That was announced a couple of days ago. Yegor Jowman of Brooklyn. He would be on my second team as of today when we do this, I guess, before the regular season ends. Like, he's not going to be on because he's just done. But shout out to him for the shooting. And as the season went on, the efficiency wasn't always there. But the biggest question mark around him was like, hey, can you deal with ball pressure? Can you get downhill at all? And like, seeing that aggression on drives perk up, I think that helped unlock some of the playmaking, which was really the selling point for him coming in. That plus the three-point shooting. It's like, okay, I like what I'm seeing here. So he's in for now, won't be in for long. Ace Bailey is in for me as well. And it's funny, when I brought Ace up back in January and that flowed into like Yusuf Nurkic praise, you were not at all prepared for, as Yusuf Nurkic was just in the middle of a triple-double streak. And like, now he's since been ruled out for the season, et cetera. But Ace just, I love the way that he's used in Utah. His size pops on the screen every time I see him. It just feels like he's coming off of a flare or some kind of a handoff. And then it's just someone smaller defending him. And whenever he sees someone smaller, it's like, yep, you're coming with me. It's not always the most explosive drive. And that's where some of the finishing at the rim can get a little hazy. But it's just like the process for me. It's like, I have an advantage. I'm attacking you. You're tilted. I can win here. I'm learning how to get into some of these shoulder nudges. I'm changing the pacing on like my gathers to make sure I can create a little bit more space for myself. I'm trying to finish around folks. Again, efficiency isn't all the way there, but like, I like what I'm seeing on that front. In addition to some of the passing reads he can make, he's been up for the challenge defensively at the very least. On ball, off ball, it can be a real adventure for him, but that is just rookie stuff. But Ace is in for me, which means Trey Johnson, who was on my second team, he's an honorable mention for me back when we did this in January. Jeremiah Fears was also on my second team, so he's an honorable mention for me right now. Either of those guys can cycle back in, especially if Colin Murray-Boyles continues to miss time. Again, Yegor is out, so like, I would imagine one of those two are going to slide in anyway. But then I kind of got into thinking about the rookies that are on play-in / playoff teams that are doing good things, but like, the role or the minutes may have them a little bit behind. So like, Ryan Kalkbrenner was someone I was super high on to start the season. Super deep drop, going to contest everything, going to block a bunch of shots. The screening could be a little bit better, but like, the screening was pretty, it was solid at the very least. Just room for upside on that front. Very simple role. He was finishing everything. I think at the time we talked about him the first time, he was on the stretch where he converted like 80% of his shots over like a 5 or 6 game span. It's like, holy crap. Well, if he's going to be this, I think you take that. But then he got hurt. And as he got hurt, the Hornets hit their role, because like, it was always Ryan Kalkbrenner kind of sets the tone, deep drop, contest shots, whatever. And then Musa Diabate comes in and he's going to be activity based. He's going to switch, crush the offensive glass, et cetera. Ryan Kalkbrenner goes down, Musa Diabate just has to start. And like, that starting lineup in general just took off. And the Hornets as a whole just took off. And so like, it's felt kind of quieter since Kalkbrenner's been back, since he's coming off the bench. But like, he is still very much doing screening, contest shot, block shot, finish at the rim things. And so I don't think he's far off. He was never far off from me anyway, but like, he's in that discussion for me. Hugo Gonzalez in Boston. I really enjoy watching him play basketball. I love watching him defend, the screening on and off the ball, the cutting, the offensive rebounds. I go back to the Milwaukee game, I think last week. It was the Giannis returns. What is it going to look like? Boston sitting, folks. What is this really going to look like? And Hugo's like, yeah, 18 and 16, 5 offensive rebounds, 5 stocks. Take 8 threes, make 3 of them. Like, it's like, oh, well, I'm not expecting him to average that, of course. But it's just like, oh, well, this is just a culmination of, I will fill gaps. I will not that one given. If you are late to a ball, I will get there. Whether that's a loose ball, offensive rebound, deflection, whatever the case may be. And like, whenever he's been called upon, like you mentioned Baylor Shireman a little bit earlier, but whenever Hugo's been called upon, I will defend whoever you ask me to. I am going to be annoying and we're likely going to win my minutes. But to the minutes point, he's averaging 15 and a half this year. So it's just like, I don't know how to place him versus some of these other guys that have more responsibility. That's kind of tough. Will Richard was a guy that I enjoyed watching in Golden State earlier on this year. Still do. his shooting, his cutting, some of the passes that he's put on film against tilted defenses in fun. He's taken on some tough defensive assignments as well. And it's just like, okay, well, your minutes aren't all the way up there either. Like, it's kind of felt like the roles kind of fluctuated as the year's gone on and trades have been made, et cetera. So I'm curious to see how he closes out the season. And so I'm just kind of thinking about these guys. Like, what do I do as we get closer to the end? Because to your earlier point, it is not easy to impact winning and to do so on good teams and to earn the trust to have the opportunity to do so. So, like, I want to salute those guys, but they don't have the same responsibility as some of the others. So those are some other guys that I'm thinking about at the very least. So yeah, just empty the notes on the rookies. Can I give some quick shout outs real quick while we're here?
I would put the emphasis on quick, brother.
I will do that. Just as I was doing some filtering since the last time we did this. So since January 23rd, Nolan Traore in Brooklyn, 12-5, averaging a steal per game. Really enjoyed his drives. Neat Clifford in Sacramento, since we talked about Maxine Raynaud, getting more responsibility as all of the high money guys have kind of, they've opted for surgery and have been ruled out. 12-5-3 for him in a steal and a half. Like, I've enjoyed him on both ends. And Will Riley in Washington, if we're talking about the bucket getting. Trey Johnson, also obviously knocking down a bunch of shots, a lot of threes. Will Riley checks in and is like, yeah, I got this. You may not know how I get to my spots, but I'm getting there. I am taking all of these shots. He's been one of the top rookie scorers over the past month and a half or so. So just wanted to get some quick shout outs there. But those are my rookie thoughts, Steve. I have done it.
Have you emptied all your notes out? Can we hit the horns now?
Yeah, we can hit the horns in the interest of time.
We'll all right. So.
and no CB agreed to yet. So I guess we'll get that news later. Hashtag darn. Hashtag please get it done, though. And with that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. We have some fun content coming your way, and you want to check in with the pod anyway, so go ahead and do that. You can follow me on socials at TheKaiusNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.